The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're already at the end of the work week. Friday is upon us. Lots to get to on today's program. We had a bit of fun last night in Birmingham, as I mentioned yesterday. The children, the McDonald children, and my two children had their dance recital. And we actually were on hand to film the occasion. Our beloved producers for this radio program, also videographers, so multitasking, wearing many hats, and hopefully the footage will turn out well for that as we put together a little video on the performance. I would just remind you that the Irish dancers, the step dancers there in Edmond, they have a recital in Armstrong Auditorium on Sunday, I believe. I'm not sure what the time for that performance is, but if you live in the central Oklahoma area, you don't want to miss that performance coming up on Sunday. Well, just to give you a little bit of a heads up on some content we hope to get into next week, we've got some of our researchers working on a 40-day timeline, 40 days, give or take, from early December 2016 to President Trump's inauguration toward the end of January 2017. That's a fascinating transition period. It's obviously the outgoing Antiochus administration and the incoming Jeroboam administration, and two very different directions, as my father has been writing and speaking about. And we're just trying to dig up as much as we can on that transition period because, so much of it is crucially important now, given all of the investigations, all of the details regarding Spygate, as President Trump calls it. So, as I say, hopefully we can let you in on some of that research that we're doing sometime next week, perhaps with more than one program. Well, speaking of more than one program, yesterday I didn't quite get to all of the information or the content that I wanted to get to about who really is targeting or was targeting journalists. And if we have time coming up later on today's show, we'll try to wrap that up as well. Actually, these first couple of stories that I want to get into today, I think that they do relate to the topic that we discussed with you yesterday. But if you didn't hear that one, it probably would be a good lead-in to what we'll discuss. So if you're listening to this as a podcast, go ahead and hit pause right about now and go back to the trumpet.com website or kpcg.fm, and you can listen to the previous show, which was posted yesterday afternoon. I want to begin with my father's article, Saving America from the Radical Left, a quote here that we've used multiple times over the last couple of months. But he says here, Donald Trump has proved himself willing to take a stand where others have not. He's proved that already in less than a year and a half, to take a stand where others, they just won't do it. And Mr. Trump, of course, he's not a perfect man. Certainly, there are things in his past, like with anyone, that no one would or should want to applaud. But to his credit, he has taken a stand. And as my father said, it's quite something to behold, him resisting these anti-American forces. I mean, that's what he's up against. He's up against high-profile individuals who are anti-American. That's the truth of it. Yesterday, the president gave a full pardon to popular conservative author and filmmaker Dinesh D'Souza, saying that D'Souza had been treated very unfairly by our government. He's talking about the Obama government. because that's when he was prosecuted back in 2014. D'Souza was convicted for making illegal campaign contributions. And that goes back to a 2012 Senate campaign. And there were two charges leveled against him, D'Souza, that is. He reimbursed what's they're called straw donors. So basically, he gave to this campaign, I forget the name of the Senate candidate. She didn't win. She got crushed, in fact. In any event, he gave $5,000 to this woman, his friend, in support of her campaign. And then he brought in two other couples, the husband and the wife in both couples, and asked them to give $5,000 each. That was the maximum amount. And then he repaid them the $20,000 in total. So he gave $20,000 beyond what he was lawfully able to do. And that violated campaign contribution rules or laws that were in place. And because of that crime, he could have been sentenced to up to 2 years in prison. There were two charges, as I say. The second charge was making false statements to the government. And as I think Andy McCarthy pointed out at the time, I mean, really, you can't secretively donate $5,000 to someone's campaign through someone else without also making a false statement when that someone else says, yeah, I made this contribution, and not revealing that, well, I'm going to be reimbursed by this other guy. So McCarthy said it was sort of like a double sentence or a double investigation, investigating him on these two counts, which were really one and the same. In any event, the second count, I mean, that could have put an individual in jail for up to 5 years. So that's what D'Souza was facing. And going into it, D'Souza confessed right up front, but told the judge, this was basically his argument, he told the judge that, look, it's not fair to be prosecuted to the full extent of the law or to be penalized with this kind of a prison term over a $20,000 contribution, which I admit that I made, which I admit was wrong. But the Obama Justice Department aggressively went after him. See, it just like we discussed yesterday on the program, the Obama administration was aggressive in going after Dinesh D'Souza. So he's in this court battle in 2014. He confesses, and the judge says, look, I'm still going forward with this. I'm not going to accept your defense that this is unfair because it never happens with anyone else. And so going forward, he really didn't have much of a defense then, since the judge said, we're going to go through with this all the way to the end. So what happened was D'Souza admitted to, you know, doing the wrong, and then he pled guilty. And it was a plea deal, basically, that if he pled guilty to this and this, or the first charge rather, then the second charge would be dropped. So he was just facing up to 2 years in prison. So ultimately, the outcome of that case was that he was fined $30,000. And again, the Justice Department wanted to put him in prison as well. And D'Souza had a pretty good lawyer at the time who convinced the judge not to imprison him. But he still ended up with 5 years of probation and also 8 months confinement to a halfway house. So not a full-scale prison, but basically 8 months in jail or 8 months confined to a home. That's what happened back in 2014. And of course, at the time, the conservatives, whether they were really supportive of D'Souza's writings and films or not, they were up in arms at just how unfair this penalty was. Even Alan Dershowitz, we've quoted from him or played clips from him a number of times, the liberal attorney, who said that it raises the question of why he was being selected for prosecution among the many, many people who commit similar crimes, as Dershowitz said. So why would D'Souza be singled out? That's the question. Not that you defend his behavior and even some sort of penalty for that matter, but why was the penalty so harsh? Why did the Obama people just throw the book at him? Well, it had a lot to do with things that he had written and films that he had produced. Specifically, The Roots of Obama's Rage. That was a book from 2010 or 11, I think. And then the film that he made in 2000, I think it was 11. It was leading up to the election in 2012. And basically, in this documentary, it was the second most popular documentary in American history. But he basically laid out for viewers that, look, if he's reelected in 2012, this is how America is going to look in 2016 after four more years of Barack Obama. That was the title of the film, 2016, Obama's America. What are we looking at? If he gets reelected, then what will America be like 4 years later? So it's no coincidence that the Obama DOJ, that the Obama White House, which despised this conservative commentator, aggressively went after him, just like the examples we mentioned yesterday. They went after him because, well, he was speaking some truth. And like it says in Isaiah 59 and verse 15, when you do that, you make yourself a prey or a target. So, I mean, on this program, I mean, obviously we're here to give you God's perspective. And none of these commentators or politicians like Donald Trump, who has proven himself to take a stand, he's willing to do it. And he's hardly perfect, morally speaking. And D'Souza certainly has his moral failings as well. We all do. But there's something to be said for speaking out, for proving yourself to be willing to take a stand, rather than just cave into the pressure coming from these, as my father said, these anti-American forces. Truth fails, like the prophet Isaiah says. It's being cast to the ground. It's not valued as it once was. Both sides of the political spectrum, they can't agree on what is truth and what is not truth. And over and again, you see this atrocious double standard. That's because truth has fallen into the street. Listen to this. This was going back to 2014, so I think this was the day or the day after D'Souza was either convicted or sentenced, I forget which, but he's on Fox News discussing this trial with Megyn Kelly at the time. It's from May 20th, 2014. Here's clip one.
And I was facing two charges, Megyn. The first one was exceeding the campaign finance limits. The second one was causing the government, the election commission, to file a false report. And that second charge carried a maximum of five years in prison. So what happened is I pleaded guilty to the charge of exceeding the campaign finance limits, and the government agreed to drop the other charge.
There was really never any doubt that you did it. I mean, well, your defense in this case was not, I didn't do it. It was, you know, I didn't do it with any intent. I didn't do it with the right requisite state of mind. And it's selective prosecution by the government, who doesn't go after anybody for this kind of crime, except coincidentally, one of the president's biggest critics. But the judge didn't allow you to bring that defense.
Yeah, interestingly, I didn't say at the beginning I didn't exceed the limits, and now I'm saying the opposite. On the contrary, the facts of the case that I, you know, induced two of my close associates to contribute, I reimbursed them. I did do that, and actually that was wrong. I should not.
It's an end around campaign finance laws.
Yes, it's an end around campaign finance. So I acknowledge responsibility, and I did admit doing that from the beginning, mm-hmm. But I did. Contest the issue of selective prosecution. Why was I being... So we made a motion before the judge on selective prosecution, but in a ruling last week, he said, no, you can't bring that into the case. Mm-hmm. So what really happened is I was going into a trial with, in a sense, no defense. And so it seemed to me wise to have the second charge.
It wasn't just you that thought this might be selective prosecution. Just so our viewers know, Alan Dershowitz, who's a liberal Democrat, thought this might be selective prosecution. Ted Cruz, he united Alan Dershowitz and Ted Cruz in this view. Four U.S. senators wrote a letter demanding to know what the basis for bringing this particular charge against you was, since we've had so many instances of others doing similar things. The Washington Times points out in an editorial yesterday that Mr. Obama's 2008 presidential campaign was itself fined almost $400,000 in 2013 for failing to disclose millions of dollars in contributions and missing deadlines for refunding excess contributions. No one was threatened with prison. Is this about Dinesh D'Souza, or is this about upholding campaign finance laws?
That last bit that she brings up there about the Obama campaign, that fine that they were slapped with in 2013, $400,000 because of illegal campaign contributions, going back to the 2008 campaign. Not $20,000. $2 million in irregular contributions. And then the administration at the time, too, they were dragging their feet all through, I forget how many months, but all of these suspect donations that were going beyond what they were supposed to donate, exactly what Dinesh D'Souza was convicted of in 2014. And yet no investigate. I mean, yes, the FEC did penalize them or fine them. And that's typically what happens in these smaller cases, like with Dinesh D'Souza. So there was a fine, one of the biggest in history, with respect to that Obama violation. But beyond that, no investigations, certainly no prosecutions. The U.S. News and World Report at the time, this is from 2013, an FEC audit, that's all that happened, just an audit of Obama for America's 2008 records, found the committee failed to disclose millions of dollars in contributions and dragged its feet in refunding millions more in excess contributions. It did not disclose millions of dollars in contributions. They were very slippery in the way that they set up their website for receiving contributions. And they were coming in from all over the world. He was popular worldwide. And this audit, years after the fact, it revealed these many violations. It says the resulting fine, one of the largest ever handed down by the FEC, is the result of a failure to disclose or improperly disclosing thousands of contributions to Obama for America during the then senator's 2008 presidential run. So we're talking about thousands of contributors, not one of them prosecuted. Andy McCarthy, writing about a month ago, this is in response actually to the pardon yesterday. He says D'Souza was and is a strident anti-Obama critic. He committed a trivial campaign finance violation. This is not to excuse the conduct. Okay, that's a point that needs to be stressed. It's not to excuse the conduct, but look, even D'Souza himself at the time, he didn't excuse the conduct. You just heard it in that clip. He says, look, I was wrong. I shouldn't have done it. I admitted I was wrong from the beginning. But how about having a standard that applies to everyone? The same standard, that is. That was his point. This is not to excuse the conduct. It is to reaffirm the principle that the punishment should fit the crime, Andy McCarthy says. And to observe that the conduct at issue is typically not treated as a crime at all. Routinely, misconduct of the kind engaged in by D'Souza is settled by payment of an administrative fine to the Federal Election Commission. In stark contrast, the Obama Justice Department not only selectively prosecuted D'Souza, prosecutors turned the case into a multiple felony indictment. They went after him aggressively. It's the same story as James Risen, James Rosen, Cheryl Atkinson. It's the same story as the AP reporters. And here's another reporter, okay, from the conservative media, but still, he's writing columns, he's writing books, he's producing films, and because they were critical of Barack Obama, Barack Obama's DOJ went after him using a left-wing prosecutor in New York. And I mean, they went all the way. by the letter of the law all the way through. They would have rather seen him in prison for 2 years. Well, probably 7 years. The New York Times, in reporting on this today, the pardon, talked about the $30,000 fine together with the confinement center, 8 months in a confinement center. And it described the scene yesterday on Air Force One. All these journalists, these reporters surrounding Donald Trump, the president, so much for suppressing their freedom of the press. There they were surrounding him, obviously not agreeing with what the president had just done. And the president looking right back at them and saying he was treated unfairly. He's proven himself to be willing to take a stand where others have not. The New York Times says D'Souza also supports Mr. Trump's unproven claim that the FBI planted a spy, quote unquote, inside his campaign. So you see how the left-wing media is framing this story about the pardon. This is nothing more than President Trump looking out for his cronies. He's a prolific tweeter as well, D'Souza. He's right on board with all these conspiracy theories. He even supports President Trump's unproven claim about the FBI spy. Truth fails. Truth has been cast to the ground. It's fallen into the street, as Isaiah the prophet said. That's an apt description of what you see coming out from not just the media, but these powerful government agencies. Look at this case about Tommy Robinson. Here in the UK, this is the one that I just referred to in passing a few days ago, that he was put in jail, I think, for 13 months. He went to jail this past week. And when there was the big confrontation out on the street, he was filming. These rape gangs are in trial. I forget where, Leeds maybe it is. He was outside doing a live Facebook feed that violated a judge's order from a year ago or so. He was on, I guess, what you could call probation. And what was really shocking wasn't so much the fact that he was arrested on the spot and sent right off to jail, but it was the gag order that this judge put upon media here in the UK. Everyone except for the Independent. Now, the Independent was left-wing. They came out and they really trashed Tommy Robinson, so that they weren't required to pull their story down like some of the others here in the UK. The gag order has since been lifted. But Douglas Murray gives us an excellent piece today at National Review, giving a rundown of the case revolving Robinson, what he's been protesting, why he was put in jail, and how that really, what's of primary concern here is something that's just kind of brushed aside or kept under the rug. It says, anyhow, Robinson wised up slightly. He's talking about his previous involvement with this controversial group 5-10 years ago, the English Defense League. He has since left that organization, and now he considers himself a citizen journalist. So he's wised up, Murray says, and eventually began to plow his energies into a type of citizen journalism activism. Some of this has been remarkably brave, some of it remarkably wrong, and some remarkably ill-advised, not least because it has allowed him to be presented in the worst possible light. So further on in the piece here, here's Douglas Murray. He says, in March, Robinson was suspended from Twitter, where he had almost 500,000 followers, the social media site, which merrily allows terrorist groups, and then it lists all of them off here, decided that Robinson should be suspended for tweeting out a statistic about Muslim rape gangs that itself originated from the Muslim-run Killian Foundation. So Twitter suspends him, his account. because he's just repeating a fact from another Muslim organization or foundation. Murray says, and it's on this matter that the latest episode in the Robinson drama started and has now drawn worldwide attention. He says 10 years ago, or rather 10 years on, I think 10 years was when this scandal first surfaced, either in Rochdale or maybe it was some other community first and then Rochdale. In any event, I mean, this has been going on for 10 years. And these rape gangs, it's like every few months there's another city in the UK. It says 10 years on, every month brings news of another town in which gangs of men, almost always of Pakistani origin, have been found to have raped young, often underage, white girls. But the whole subject is so ugly and uncomfortable that very few people care to linger over it. Robinson is an exception. Okay, so he's exposing this. And in some ways, he's doing it, like in the case last week, in a way that violates a judge's order. There's no getting around that. But it says here, for him, the grooming gangs issue isn't something that afflicts some far-off towns, but people in the working-class communities that he knows. And while there are journalists who have spent considerable time and energy bringing this appalling phenomenon to light, most of British society has turned away in a combination of embarrassment, disgust, and uncertainty about how to even talk about this subject. I mean, it has gotten some coverage. It's not fair to say. Richard sent me just a snapshot today of a lot of front pages of newspapers over the years that have had this as front page news. So it's not fair to say it's not even discussed. I mean, it is discussed, but not at length. And if it does make the headline one day, it very quickly disappears, quite unlike one of President Trump's tweets. Murray says, anyone who thinks Britain is much further along with dealing with the taboo of grooming gangs should remember that only last year, the Labour MP for Rotherham, Sarah Champion, had to leave the shadow cabinet because she accurately identified the phenomenon. I mean, she just brought it up. And that's the real travesty here, is that all of Britain knows about it. They know it's going on. It has made headlines, but no one in government does anything about it. In fact, someone, if they're in government, if they do bring it up, like Sarah Champion, well, she's going to lose her position. Murray says here, the whole affair is in many ways maddening. Maddening that Robinson stepped over the line and had been very clearly drawn for him. Maddening that he gave the police and courts a legitimate reason to arrest him. And maddening because, as he must have known, it is by now abundantly clear that every arm of the British state has been out to get Tommy Robinson from the moment he emerged on the scene in Luton a decade ago. He has had the whole state against him. It's a deep state here in the UK. It says the problem is that any challenge Robinson presents is all a secondary issue. So here's the key point that Murray makes in his piece at National Review yesterday. Any challenge Robinson presents is all a secondary issue. The primary issue is that for years, the British state allowed gangs of men to rape thousands of young girls across Britain. For years, the police, politicians, Crown Prosecution Service, and every other arm of the state, ostensibly dedicated to protecting these girls, failed them. As a number of government inquiries have concluded, they turned their face away from these girls because they were terrified of the accusations of racism and would come their way, if they did address them. They decided it wasn't worth the aggravation. See, they could be charged with racism, so they just turned a blind eye to it. Quite unlike what they did last Friday, when Tommy Robinson showed up on the street with his live Facebook. They didn't turn a blind eye to that. So the question here with so many of these stories that we keep seeing is, what is of primary importance and what is of secondary importance? It's not to say that the secondary matters shouldn't be addressed with. And it is maddening, like Murray brings out, that Robinson stepped over the line, a line that had been clearly drawn for him. It's maddening that he gave the police and courts a legitimate reason to arrest him. But when you look at the crimes being committed here, I mean, what is of primary importance here? Muslim rape gangs or violating probation regarding citizen journalism outside of a courtroom? What is of primary and what is of secondary importance? Illegally contributing $20,000 to the campaign of a senator? Or $2 million of campaign violations during the presidential election of 2008. Douglas Murray says here at the end of his article, what can be said with absolute certainty is that Tommy Robinson has been treated with greater suspicion and greater presumption of guilt by the United Kingdom than any Islamic extremist or mass rapist ever has been. That's what we can conclude from all of this with absolute certainty. He has been treated with greater suspicion and greater presumption of guilt. They've been out for him for years. And it's maddening that he gave him an excuse to finally lock him up. He should have known better. But what is of primary and what is of secondary importance? Murray says that should be, yet is not, a national scandal. The fact that they've treated him with greater suspicion and greater presumption of guilt than any Islamic extremist or mass rapist, that's the national scandal here. He says if even one mullah or sheikh had been treated with the presumption of guilt that Robinson has received, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the rest of them would be all over the UK authorities, but different standards apply to Robinson. See, it's just like with Dinesh D'Souza. Those violations, they go on all the time. And if you're part of the Obama team, it's a slap on the wrist and you move forward. But if you're Dinesh D'Souza, it's two felonies, not one, two. It's prison time. It's pretty amazing, like Richard pointed out this morning, coming back to this point about government inaction and what it is that they focus on and what it is that's of primary importance to them following the brouhaha last Friday. The primary important thing to deal with is, of course, Tommy Robinson, and then telling the media, don't you talk about any details of this case. 10 years on, and still, it's hard to find any senior government leader who has the courage to even talk about this. And when you look at all of the unimportant things that they comment on endlessly, like the President of the United States tweets, here again, what is of primary importance? Look at the front pages of the news these past 10 years of the UK, and periodically you do have some pretty good coverage, and there have been a few good reporters that have exposed these rape gangs, these Muslim rape gangs. But what has been done? What has changed since Rochdale? We've had a three-part series on the BBC here in the UK. And what has changed? How is it different now in Oxford or Leeds, these other places where these things are happening? How has the government changed its approach? just to repeat what my father said regarding the uniqueness of Donald Trump. I mean, he's proven himself to be willing to take a stand where others, many, many others, have not. And you think about that history there in 2 Kings 14, history and prophecy, as we now know, about Jeroboam II, back in the days of ancient Israel, that long, prosperous reign, 41 years. I mean, the Bible says about Jeroboam II that he was evil in the sight of the Eternal. He had his flaws, just like Dinesh D'Souza, just like Donald Trump, just like Tommy Robinson. But in the case of Mr. Trump, at least, he's proven himself willing to take a stand and to at least confront these anti-American forces. And look at the mercy in the case of that Old Testament example. Look at the mercy God had on Israel anciently. It says in 2 Kings 14, verse 26, "For the Eternal saw the affliction of Israel, that it was very bitter, for there was not any shut up, nor any left, nor any helper for Israel. And the Eternal said that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven." Sorry, the Eternal said not that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. See, a temporary resurgence, an opportunity to take a stand where others have not, an opportunity to turn to God, to turn to a merciful and loving God who's giving us one last opportunity to get right with Him. When we come back, we'll try to wrap up that study we went through yesterday regarding the targeting of journalists. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, and even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily.
They've prosecuted more whistleblowers and targeted more journalists than any other administration, than all previous administrations combined.
That's James Risen, who worked for the New York Times, talking about the Obama administration responsible for prosecuting more whistleblowers and targeting more journalists than any other administration, and even if you combine them all. Barack Obama's is still the worst.
It's like they're creating a police state within the government.
It's like a police state, he said. That's stunning. I guess that didn't get much attention, though. It was back from 2014. That was right in the midst of the Obama years. And yet, as I said yesterday, I played that collage for you yesterday, or that montage. All of these reporters in full-scale panic mode, because they're under attack, they say. President Trump's going to persecute them. Susan Rice, she was right up there in the White House with Barack Obama. Remember the op-ed piece she had in December, just a few months ago? She said, President Trump routinely trashes our most respected news outlets as fake news, threatening their personnel and operations. The audacity for someone from the Obama White House to say that it's Donald Trump who's threatening reporters. Who was it that was threatening reporters, including James Risen? What about his op-ed piece from a year earlier? I just referenced it yesterday. I didn't go through any of it, but he wrote in December 2016, if Donald J. Trump decides as president to throw a whistleblower in jail for trying to talk to a reporter or gets the FBI to spy on a journalist, we will have one man to thank for bequeathing him such expansive power, Barack Obama. He wrote that right at the end of 2016. And of course, he's probably a liberal journalist like the rest of them at the New York Times. And he went on to speculate that, well, I think President Trump, given what he said on the campaign trail, given the nonstop charges of fake news, he's coming after the media. But look, if he actually takes those words and translates it into action, if he takes the rhetoric from the campaign trail and acts on it and actually throws a whistleblower in jail or spies on a reporter, who does he have to thank for that? Who's the one that cleared the way for him to do that? Who's the one that weaponized the DOJ and the FBI and the NSA? Risen says, over the past 8 years, he's speaking of the Obama years, the administration has prosecuted 9 cases involving whistleblowers and leakers, compared with only 3 by all previous administrations combined. Did you hear this? 3 times as much as all previous administrations combined. Risen says it has repeatedly used the Espionage Act, a relic of World War I era red baiting, not to prosecute spies, but to go after government officials who talk to journalists. I mean, the Espionage Act was there, like its name implies, so that the government could go after spies. Obama used it to go after government officials who talked to journalists. In the mind of Barack Obama, that's espionage. Risen says, under Mr. Obama, the Justice Department and the FBI have spied on reporters by monitoring their phone records, labeled one journalist an unindicted co-conspirator in a criminal case for simply doing reporting, and issued subpoenas to other reporters to try to force them to reveal their sources and testify in criminal cases. And as Risen goes on to bring out, look, I experienced all this firsthand. They came after me for 7 years. And in fact, they won in court. It was a split decision. Then it was kicked up to the Supreme Court, and they refused to hear it or decided not to hear it. And so the ball finally, right there toward the end of the Obama administration, the ball was in the Obama's DOJ's court. And they finally relented, even though they had won in court. They relented, as James Risen says, because they feared the negative publicity they'd get from sending a New York Times reporter to prison. So they threatened, they prosecuted, they carried on with this for 7 years, intimidating to get him to reveal his sources so that they could then go after the leakers. So that they could then go after the government officials who were talking to journalists. And then finally, when it came down to the fact that Risen wasn't going to reveal his sources and therefore going off to prison, finally there, right at the last, the Obama administration finally backed away. Risen says here in a scathing 2013 report for the Committee to Protect Journalists, Leonard Downey, a former executive editor of the Washington Post, who now teaches at Arizona State University, said the war on leaks and other efforts to control information, notice that, to control information was the most, this is a quote from this Leonard Downey, it was the most aggressive I've seen since the Nixon administration when I was one of the editors involved in the Washington Post investigation of Watergate. So remember that next time you hear one of these reporters just casually say, Trump, I've never seen anything like Trump. I haven't seen anything like this since the Nixon administration. This was James Risen at the New York Times in December 2016, the last few weeks of the Obama administration. He says, finally, the administration's heavy-handed approach represents a sharp break with tradition. For decades, official Washington did next to nothing to stop leaks. For decades, it's just like with those campaign violations. For the most part, the government didn't do much of anything to stop it. Or if they did, it was a fine, like President Trump said on Air Force One yesterday. It was a fine. It was a slap on the wrist. Risen says occasionally the CIA or some other agency nettled by an article or broadcast would loudly proclaim that it was going to investigate a leak, but then would merely go through the motions and abandon the case. But not so. Not so with the Obama administration. This is me talking now. Risen said, look, this is how it went for decades. And then Barack Obama shows up, promising transparency, promising freedom for journalists. But what were his actions? What were his deeds? The Bible says that we're to judge by fruits. What were the actions of the Obama administration? Well, you've got an 8-year track record, and you've got all these examples. And then just the fact that he was coming on board in 2008 or 2009, promising to transform, to radically transform the United States of America. He certainly did that. Well, look at these examples, one after another. James Risen, all those AP reporters, the Fox News reporter, James Rosen. Listen to, I think I played this one for you yesterday, but listen again to James Rosen of Fox News describing what they did to him, what the Obama DOJ did to him. This is clip 4.
The surveillance extended, for example, to monitoring my whereabouts and my use of the swipe badge that I had as a member of the State Department press corps, when I was leaving the building, where I was using telephones and so forth. And that was attributed to Eric Holder, who later told The Washington Post that it was the greatest regret of his tenure, and that by all accounts, this was illegal and unprecedented. Not even Neil Sheehan, who was the New York Times reporter back in 1971, who published the Pentagon Papers, mm-hmm. 7,000 classified documents, was designated by the Nixon administration as a criminal co-conspirator in a violation of the Espionage Act. So that was an honor that I had all unto myself.
That's James Rosen of Fox News speaking back in 2017, last year. They were spying on him. That's what he's describing there. Surveillance. I mean, it went beyond just monitoring where he was, the swipe badge and so on. The telephones, who he was calling. Eric Holder was behind that. Now, he said it was his greatest regret after he was caught. But these were illegal and unprecedented actions on the part of the Obama DOJ. Pure and simple. Police state. It's like my father said in Great Again. Quickly moving America toward rule by dictatorship or tyranny. That's what was happening before God decided to save Israel or to save America. Temporarily, Mr. Obama had all the right words. I played that clip yesterday. Well, he spoke with confidence. We don't spy on anyone. We don't spy on Americans. James Clapper said the same thing. No, we don't spy. And then you hear the same thing today, something they were bragging about a little over a year ago. The fact that they were spying. You know all the articles. We've gone through some of them for you on this program. From last January, last February, last March, all the intel agencies coordinating loosening some of the strictures put upon those intel agencies as far as spreading information goes. All of that, I mean, that was being changed as Obama was going out the door. Because he knew the deep state was going to work to bring down a president, a sitting president, the incoming president. He knew that they were targeting the Trump administration. He knew they were targeting the president-elect. And so everything was in place. We'll talk more about that, as I said, at the start of the show. We'll talk more about it next week when we look at that critical transition period. But one example after another, all the reporters, all the leakers, Cheryl Atkinson, I think I might have played this one for you yesterday as well. Here's clip six.
I think there any journalist who's been covering Washington for a few years would agree, and they've agreed in letters written to the White House and in a recognition given to the White House over its unprecedented secrecy and lack of FOIA responses and so on, that there is pressure coming to bear on journalists for just doing their job in ways that have never come to bear before. Now, there have always been tensions. There have always been calls from the White House under any administration, I assume, when they don't like a particular story. But it's particularly aggressive under the Obama administration, and I think it's a campaign that's very well organized, that's designed to have sort of a chilling effect, and to some degree has been somewhat successful in getting broadcast producers who don't really want to deal with the headache of it. Why put on these controversial stories that we're going to have to fight people on when we can fill the broadcast with other perfectly decent stories that don't ruffle the same feathers?
That's Cheryl Atkinson describing how successful the Obama administration was in suppressing the free press. This is from Joel Simon, writing back in 2015. Saying that President Obama took office in 2009 while promising all the transparency and such. It says here, this is the most closed, control-freak administration I've ever covered. It quotes another individual. The administration's war on leaks and other efforts to control information are the most aggressive I've seen since the Nixon administration. Well, that's actually the same quote from Leonard Downey, the one that put together that report. But listen to Joe Concha here. He's writing at The Hill last year, May 2nd, 2017. He says, is a sitting president's criticism of the press really a threat to the First Amendment when access and ability to report has actually improved? That's the real tragedy here as far as the outrage that you see in the left-wing media. Is the fact that it's actually better than it was, much better. Here's President Trump yesterday, surrounded by reporters on Air Force One, bombarding him with questions about, well, why did you pardon Dinesh D'Souza? All of this unlimited access. Concha says here, White House press briefings are actually more open than ever before. Reporters outside the D.C. bubble are brought in over Skype. Press passes have been given to non-traditional conservative outlets. That could help to balance the White House press corps a little bit, considering a recent survey's finding that only 3 of 63 members are registered Republicans. I mean, all that Donald Trump's doing is evening it out a little bit. I mean, you would think they'd be cheering this in the name of giving everyone a voice. 3 out of 63 in the White House press corps actually registered Republicans. Concha says here, actions always speak louder than words. Trump's words about the press are highly critical and demeaning. No argument there. Many in the press take it personally and even conflate rhetoric, Trump's free speech, as somehow endangering the First Amendment. Ah, the irony. Pretty good column here by Concha. But Obama's actions, they were downright scary. Too bad almost nobody stood up to say anything about it. Yes, indeed. It's too bad that nobody stood up to say anything about it. Really, really the only one, maybe a few others, that has proven himself willing to take a stand where others have not is Donald Trump. And it is, as my father said, quite something to behold. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We're putting the finishing touches on yet another week of broadcasting here on KPCG and KPCG.fm. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you next week.